This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Whose motorcycle is this?
It's a chopper, baby.
Whose chopper is this?
Zed's.
Who's Zed?
Zed's dead, baby. Zed's dead.
Must have the precious.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Go ahead. Make my day.
You talking to me? You talking to me?
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
Hasta la vista, baby.
I'll be back.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Obi-Wan never told you what happened to your father. I am your father.
I am Black Widow.
Say hello to my little friend!
Welcome to the Casting Couch here on Joy 94.9. My name is Thomas Caldwell, and as always, we are being produced and panelled by Alan Tuxford. Now, joining me in the studio today for the next 2 hours is Maureen O'Keefe.
Hello, Thomas.
How are you, Maureen?
I'm good. I'm very well, thanks, Thomas. Nice to be here.
Yeah, so it's always wonderful to have you sharing the microphone, Maureen. We've got a bit of a wacky show today, haven't we?
We have. We're talking about good and bad films.
Yeah. Well, we're going to start off respectable. We're going to talk about the two big releases this week, which are Precious and then Edge of Darkness. And then we're going to do something I've been wanting to do on this show for quite a while. We're going to do a bit of a reevaluation of a classic film. I mean, it's from 1994, so it's not too classic, but we're going to talk about Ed Wood. Now, Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland is coming up, mm-hmm. So it seemed appropriate to talk about one of Tim Burton's great films. But the other reason I thought Ed Wood would be a good film for us to talk about on today's show is it's a bit of a bad film special today, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. We're going to be talking to someone about bad films.
Yeah. In the second hour, we're going to be interviewing Michael Adams, who has a list of credentials to his names, which I won't go into right now because we'll be here forever. But amongst other things, he spent a year trying to watch every single bad film in existence, and he's written a book about how that's affected him and what those films are. So I'm dying to speak to him because there is just some perverse appeal about that. Now, we're also going to talk about a film called The Room, which is starting a late night. It's starting its late night season at the Nova, at Cinemanova tonight. It's going to be playing for a few Saturdays. And basically, The Room is a 2003 film that has been pretty much described as the Citizen Kane of bad movies.
I'd believe that.
Yeah, you and I went to see it. We got invited to a special shindig a couple of weeks ago where we saw it, and they got us all very drunk with free beer, and they had fans of The Room in the audience to call out stupid things throughout the film. It's a very different experience, isn't it?
It is. It's like a full-scale assault on the senses.
Yeah, and it is a truly horrific film. Now, I'm sure Michael Adams has encountered it in his research.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And that's why I'll be interested to hear how watching them one bad film a day for, you know, a whole year affected him. Because, you know, I slept really badly after just watching that one bad film.
It was pretty traumatic. And this is a really long way of getting back to the fact that we're talking about Ed Wood, not because it's a bad film, but it's about Edward D. Wood Jr., who is regarded as the worst filmmaker who ever lived.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, we would love to have a bit of interaction with our audience today to let us know what's your favourite bad film. Is it possible to love a bad film? It's so bad that you love it. Or what is, you know, the worst experience you've had watching a film where you've stormed out in absolute disgust? So please get in touch with us. You can call us on 1300-JOY-949. We'll accept SMSs on 0427-JOY-949 or email us onair@joy.org.au. We've also got the Cast and Couch Facebook page happening, and I've also for the first time decided to sit on my Twitter account today. So if you're a Twitterer, search for me, Thomas Caldwell. My Twitter name is Cinema Autopsy. If you want to find me that way, you can tell me all about what your most loathed film is. On the show today, we'll also be giving out 5 in-season double passes to Precious, courtesy of CG Publicity. A big show ahead of us. Let's get into some music now. We had an All Melbourne special last week, so I'm going to try to go to other corners of the world this week. I'm going to start off with a song by a Japanese band who are based in New York. The main motivation for me playing it is I heard this song last year and have been rather obsessed with it ever since. It's a great kind of dream pop shoegazer song by this extraordinary group called Asobi Sexu, which apparently translates as playful sex. It's Tokyo slang. It's a gorgeous song called Transparence. You're with Thomas and Maureen here on the Casting Couch, Joy 94.9. You're back on the Carson Couch with Thomas and Maureen here on Joy 94.9. And we just heard from Claire and the Reasons. That's from her album titled The Movie and a delightful little track called Pluto. Did you like that, Maureen?
It was lovely, very soothing.
Yeah, that whole album sort of has that kind of filmic sound to it. I really like it. We've got a heap of correspondence coming. It seems people love talking about bad films. We've had Will from Broadway at Bedtime has said Death Trap, the Michael Caine and Christopher Reeve film, is his favourite. He says favourite gay film. I don't know if he means it's also his favourite bad film. Are you familiar with Death Trap?
No.
So we can't make that judgment, I'm afraid. Now, Grant has got in touch to say that his worst movie experience was Stigmata. I do recall that vaguely. It's sort of a Old Testament Christian style horror film. He says, I wasn't well to start with, and all the scene flashing made me feel sick. Had to run to the toilets twice. The staff thought I was doing drugs in the bathroom. That's too bad, Grant. I'm sorry to hear that. We also got in Caroline also got in touch, Maureen, to say how much she enjoyed some programming you did a couple of weeks ago. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, it was a Taste of Radio show, and I played music from my top shelf of my CD collection, which was people I'd seen live in concert. Mm-hmm. So that's why Bruce Springsteen got a run, okay, and a few others.
Yeah. Well, you've got a fan there. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you, Caroline.
And also, g'day, Terry. Alan says, thank you for your message. We're going to talk about Precious now, or the full title, which is, I can never remember the full title because it goes on forever. Precious, based on the novel Push by Sapphire. I refuse to call it by that title. It's silly. It's a subtitle. It's just called Precious. Now, Maureen, this has got a lot of attention from overseas. It's come to Australia with some really high expectations. It's a film about a 16-year-old African-American girl living in Harlem. It's set in 1987. Now, when I say living, I use that term loosely. I think barely surviving is the best way to describe her existence. I mean, we won't go through all the woes that happened to her because a lot happened throughout the film. But at the start of the film, it's quite obvious that she's really badly obese.
Yes.
She's pregnant with her second child as the result of being raped by her father.
Yes, and he's been the father of both her children.
Yeah, yeah, that's yes, right. Yes. She's got another child, which is because of him. She can't read or write. She's illiterate. That's the word. It's some irony with me forgetting how to say the word illiterate. And she's living with her absolutely horrific mother, who is psychologically abusive, physically abusive, and even one scene, it's suggested quite heavily that she's also sexually abusive. Now, why would anybody want to see this film?
Well, it's really good acting on the part of Gabby Sidibe, who plays Precious.
Yep.
So it's extraordinary performance.
Who's a complete newcomer. She was plucked out of obscurity because she just had the kind of presence that this film required.
Yes, and I read they actually had trouble finding someone for a while. So, yep. I mean, I think they held out for someone that, you know, really delivered.
Well, she had to physically fit the part, and it's quite a physically specific part.
Yes, they didn't try and kind of tone that down at all, which I think is really impressive. One of the really impressive things about the film, like, there's no kind of makeover going to occur or anything during the film.
Yeah, exactly. You're hearing a good thing. As bleak as this film sounds, it's got some really strong things about it that are worth seeing, and the performances are one of them. Now, it's been directed by Lee Daniels. Now, it's the second film he's directed. He's previously been a producer. He did films like he produced The Woodsman and Monsters Ball. And he must have something about casting musicians and unusual people in roles, because we've got Mariah Carey in this film, Lenny Kravitz, And the comedian Monique.
Yeah,
had you ever heard of Monique?
No, I hadn't. No.
No, I think she's done a lot of sort of small comedy films in America, and she's got a talk show. Plays the mother.
Yes.
And her performance in this film is incredible.
Yeah.
Because she's a monster.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's almost painful to watch at times, which I think is probably something to mention for listeners, that I think some people probably wouldn't be able to sit through some of her scenes with Precious.
Yeah, and it's just verbal. I mean, I think that the nastiest scenes are just some of the diatribe she has against her daughter about you're stupid, you're fat, you'll amount to nothing.
Well, that's right, and the unpredictability as well, like when you're kind of knowing that or waiting for something else to happen, her reaction to something that's, you know, can be, you know, as emotionally abusive or whatever as anything.
I mean, what I found terrifying about her is she's got that, I mean, she's really stupid. Like, and then the film does show that this is a really dumb, ignorant woman, and a lot of her prejudices and hatred comes from her stupidity, but she's so almost proudly, defiantly pleased with herself for having no education, and it's just a revolting way of looking at the world, and she wants to drag everyone down to her level.
Yeah, I mean, you know, yes, I'd agree with that, but she's also very manipulative because there's that scene where the welfare worker visits and, you know, she's holding Precious's eldest child and acting all very, you know, concerned, and so, you know, she can play the game or whatever if she needs to, which is another kind of frightening thing about her, I think.
Yeah, now let's sort of not forget to mention the fact, though, that this film advances. It doesn't wallow in horribleness. This is about Precious getting out of this situation, and she goes to an alternative school where she meets a very inspirational teacher and a very supportive group of classmates who all come from fairly traumatic backgrounds or they're at-risk students themselves.
And they're vivid characters, the girls in the school. So, yeah, they were enjoyable scenes to watch.
Yeah, and I think brought a bit of humour and lightness and hope to the film. And I think overall there is a message of hope that this character can break free of all this stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, like with the help of her teacher. I mean, some of that was kind of, I thought, like, in a way not shown very clearly about how Precious's transformation, which, like, you sort of see halfway through where there's a big smile and laughing on screen. And, like, that was really striking because you realised how impassive she'd been up until then.
No, I think you struck on something there. I think structurally this film is basic. And I think it is sort of a string of strong scenes that doesn't really have a narrative sophistication. I don't think it quite develops convincingly.
Yeah, and it's interesting you say that because the final scene, I sort of wondered a bit. That's the thing I kept thinking about, and I thought, it's a powerful scene, but it felt a bit kind of tacked on, or that they needed to spell things out for you, which I thought you'd already, you know, had already been vividly conveyed throughout the film.
I very much hear you. And also, there's several scenes where you see her going into this flights of fantasy where she imagines herself in very sophisticated scenarios, and there's a bit of magical realism. I found that forced. I didn't think the film needed that.
Well, that's interesting because I did hear Gabby Sidibe say in an interview that those scenes were put in to allow the audience to breathe, that they felt it was, you know, like to sort of, like, I guess, relax the trauma for a while. So I didn't mind them. I didn't mind them for that.
Yeah, I felt it showed a bit of lack of confidence from the director with the material. Okay. Look, I'm going to give this... I don't think this film is as good as everyone says, but I think it's still a very important and a very... good film. I'm going to give it a sort of strong 3.5 stars out of 5.
Yeah, I'll give it 4.
A 4 from Maureen. Mm. Okay, well, that's a very high recommendation. We're talking about Precious, and we're going to do a giveaway for that later on in the show. We're now going to hear heavy film, so let's go to a very wonderful, callful piece, a song by Marvin Gaye. This is What's Going On. You're listening to Thomas and Maureen on the Casting Couch. Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
I purchased a pixel.
I purchased a pixel too.
Our business purchased 7 pixels.
And together we built a rainbow of joy.
It costs Joy 94.9 approximately $13,000 a week to bring you the best radio 24 hours a day. And we're determined to keep delivering this to you.
The 2009 global financial crisis hit Joy hard.
So over the next 12 months, we're building a rainbow of joy in the station foyer to not only raise much-needed funds, but also as a unique way for you to show your support for your favourite station with a personalised message.
Purchase a pixel in the rainbow of joy for only $40.
Or families, community groups and businesses can purchase 7 pixels for just $250.
Become part of the joy rainbow and help secure joy's future.
Rainbow of joy!
Call 1-300-JOY-949.
All day. All day. All night. Joy 94.9.
You're back on the casting couch with Thomas and Maureen. Now, Maureen, we are going to be talking about bad films, like classic bad films in the second hour. Mm-hmm. And a couple of people have got in touch with me via my Twitter account. Now, before we came on air, you told me that you really dislike Garden State and you're worried that you were the only person who felt that strongly against that film.
That's right.
Well, I can tell you right now, I'm not a fan either. And on Twitter, a chap called Jimmy the Exploder, a.k.a. Jimmy Jack, who was the guy who wrote and co-produced The Black Balloon, AFI-winning film. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about someone in the industry with a high level of credibility. He has said, Garden State made me vomit in my mouth, not just a little bit.
Yeah, I can't believe it.
So there you go. That's an endorsement. And also, Paul Anthony Nelson, who runs the website Pulp Friction, pulpfrictionaustralia.blogspot.com, has mentioned a trilogy of films called The Lemon Groove Kids. I've never heard of this, Paul. Ray Dennis Deckler's rampantly unfunny, embarrassingly inept, seriously retarded The Lemon Groove Kids trilogy is what Paul has thrown into the barrel for us. So we'll ask our guest, Michael Adams, about that in the second hour. Mm-hmm. But now we're going to talk about Edge of Darkness. New Mel Gibson returning to acting in front of the camera.
Yeah, after 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, apparently. It's been a long time. Mm. And I don't know, is this anticipated or not? Are we looking forward to this? How do you feel about Mel?
Oh, I don't mind him. I've quite enjoyed, I think I saw the first couple of Lethal Weapons. And,
they're good films, aren't they? The first two, I love his Australian work, Mad Max. He's the man. Mm. Yeah, well, this film is a remake of a 1985 BBC television miniseries, which I actually got on DVD and watched a couple of weeks ago. Now, the film has been directed by Martin Campbell. He's the same guy who actually directed the original TV series. Mm. So far, so good. Mm-hmm. He also directed Casino Royale.
Yeah.
So his director has really kind of gone up the ranks. Now, the premise of the film and the series is quite similar. You've got a policeman in the film. He's named Thomas Craven, who comes home with his daughter one night. She's visiting. And then suddenly outside the front door, she's violently shot. Hmm. Now, the assumption is he was the designated target.
Yeah, that's
he was the one who was meant to get shot. Yeah. But it becomes quite early on in the film that he suspects this is not the case at all, that maybe his daughter was the target. And as he investigates, indeed he finds that she was part of an anti-nuclear group who are regarded as terrorists.
Yeah.
Now, what did you make of this film?
Look, I didn't mind it. I mean, I thought it started off, you know, pretty good as this kind of standard, you know, Boston cop thriller type setting.
Mm-hmm.
And when he starts following the leads, he meets Ray Winston, who's mm-hmm. playing Mr. Jedburgh. And, like, I thought he was probably the highlight of the film was their interactions, which I think would have been in the series as well.
Yeah, well, in the series, that Jedburgh character, it's an English series, so the Jedburgh character in the series is, of course, American. And he's wonderful. It's a wonderful character in the series. And the series really picks up momentum when he enters.
But do you know, apparently Robert De Niro was actually slated to play Mr. Jedburgh. And he did actually arrive on set or whatever. And after a week, he had a disagreement. So that's interesting. Wow. It wasn't always planned to be an English actor.
I thought that was a deliberate thing. Yeah. I think Rick Winston was perfect.
Yes.
What did you make of Gibson in this role?
It's sort of funny. Like, I mean, you know, I think he's kind of a good po-faced wooden kind of actor. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when he was trying to convey emotion, it seemed, I found that a bit awkward almost mm-hmm. to watch. And there were just some funny things like, you know, chasing down, you know, a couple, like the Lightflower activist leader and then just to punch him out. And, you know, and like there didn't seem to be a lot of kind of point to some of his vigilante activity.
The film lacked a degree of subtlety, yes. Yeah, I mean, the film has been heavily simplified and Americanized from the series, which I don't have a problem with.
I think it's
appropriate. I kind of like Mel in this at first because he plays the character is a mixture of a man in shock at witnessing the violent murder of his daughter, and also he's sort of a tough, stony-faced cop character. So I didn't mind that kind of wooden thing.
Yeah, but there's also kind of a slight mystical element thrown in, didn't you think, with the, hearing his dead daughter's voice as well at times?
Yeah. Which is actually even stronger in the series.
Oh, right, okay.
Yes, that she kind of actually is, you know, a character that pops out throughout the series as a sort of vision he has.
Okay.
I enjoyed this film for the most part. It does fall into the trap of being a little bit, you know, he gets information from somebody, that person then gets violently killed in front of him.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little bit like those whodunits where they say, I know who the murderer is.
That's right.
It is, bang, a bullet comes to the window and they're dead.
Yeah. And I didn't mind, you know, his whole vigilante style thing of, you know, tracking down his daughter's killers. You know, I think there's some good shoot 'em up scenes both with him and then with Ray Winston, you know.
Yeah, the film completely and utterly lost me for what we call the final act, the sort of last third where the film wraps up. I thought it derailed horribly and got very silly.
Okay.
I thought it was a good, plausible, credible action thriller that then went a bit into Dr. No territory or Death Wish territory. It just, to me, it got hyperactive.
Well, I also thought the problem was with the kind of that vigilante type film, cop film, and then with the government intrigue kind of almost psychological drama as well with Jedburgh. Like, it just seemed like there were too many elements in the film.
Yeah, okay. So you thought the film was too busy?
A bit, yeah.
Yeah, look, I really have a big issue with the ending. I was enjoying this film and I thought it completely lost the plot for the last half an hour or so.
And was that different to the series?
That didn't worry me. I mean, the film did deviate a lot from the series. It just had the central premise. I was okay with that. I just felt the way it ended was not true to the tone of the rest of the film.
Mm.
I thought it was a decent, credible film and it got very pulpy and trashy. So I was going to give this 3.5 stars, but when I walked out of the cinema after the final 20 minutes, I've pulled it down to only 2.5 stars.
I'll give it 3.
You'll give it 3.
Yeah, I'll up to you.
Edge of Darkness, you'll one up me. Yeah, that's Edge of Darkness everywhere. Now, I haven't got any music from the film Edge of Darkness, but I have got the soundtrack of the original BBC miniseries, which was composed by Michael Kamen and Eric Clapton on guitar. I think you're going to enjoy this. It's nice and eerie and menacing. So this is Eric Clapton on guitar with the theme music from the original TV series Edge of Darkness. You're with Maureen and Thomas here on Joy 94.9, The Casting Couch. That's the main theme from Ghostbusters by Elmer Bernstein. You're on the casting couch here with Thomas and Maureen. This is Joy 94.9. Now, we're talking about bad movies today on the show. We've sort of got through Precious and Edge of Darkness, which are our credible films, and now we're delving into bad movies. And we have done a call out to people to tell us what their favourite bad movies are. And on cinema, and on my cinema autopsy account on Twitter, I've had a few people get in touch. Janie Kibble got in touch to say, having watched it with some kids yesterday, Hannah Montana the movie. Shocking, tawdry, tacky, tiresome. I don't think she's the only one, Maureen. You handed me a bit of paper with a list of the Razzies on them. And Hannah Montana has been nominated for some of the Razzies. If you don't know what the Razzies are, don't worry. We'll cover that in the next hour when we talk to Michael Adams, who has been watching bad movies solidly for a year. But now we're going to have a bit of a retrospective discussion about a film from 1994 called Ed Wood. Now, Ed Wood is by no means a bad film. I actually think it's an absolute masterpiece. It's one of my favourite films of the 90s.
It's great.
It is an incredibly good film. But it's about a guy who is regarded as the worst filmmaker ever. His name is Edward D. Wood Jr. And he made films throughout the 50s, and they really are quite awful. And the film Ed Wood is Tim Burton's fairly affectionate tribute to him. What did you think of the film?
Because
you were like me. You saw it when it first came out and haven't seen it since.
That's right. And so I just watched it again during the week. And I find it a really uplifting film. Like, as you say, it is an affectionate portrayal of Ed Wood, who, you know, was a real person. Mm-hmm. So of his life during the 50s. And, I mean, it's very funny. It's got, you know, funny lines and these vivid, real people in the film, who were real people, and bizarre situations that Ed Wood gets them all into in the pursuit of making his movies, which are these visions, you know, that
these crazy science fiction horror visions and films about cross-dressing.
Yeah, well, actually, because the first movie we see being made is actually the one that becomes Glenn or Glenda, which, I mean, I think it must have been incredibly brave for him, for one thing, to make a movie like that in the 50s.
In the 50s, yeah. Well, and you got the impression from this film as well that the general community weren't that open to the idea of somebody being a cross-dresser.
Well, no, not at all. And he does, in the film, he sort of talks about that it's his story because he was a cross-dresser.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so, I mean, I don't think it's a very good film, apparently, Glenn or Glenda either.
No.
I've watched a little bit of it on YouTube, but I mean, he's just a very interesting character because he's this mixture of passion and ambition and like naivety, and I think one of his flaws might have been that he had no critical faculty whatsoever.
No, he was possibly too optimistic about his work. When you're right about it being inspirational, I remember getting a real rush from this film, thinking, if this guy can make a film, really anybody can.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he isn't very talented. But he has so much passion and desire to tell these stories, and it's infectious.
Yes, yeah. And it's also affectionate, inspiring because of, like, the people that he kind of gathers around him throughout making these movies.
It's extraordinary ensemble of people, including Bela Lugosi. And, in fact, you know, the famous classic Hollywood actor who played Dracula, who sort of was the first really prominent American portrayal of Dracula.
Oh, okay.
Bela Lugosi ended up a junkie. No one would work with him. And he just bumped into Ed Wood one day, and Ed loved him and just said, why aren't you on the screen anymore? You're this wonderful actor.
Mm.
And in fact, yeah, Bela Lugosi's final film was Plan 9 from Outer Space, which is regarded as the worst film ever made. And I have actually seen it.
Oh, okay.
And I'll tell you what, we laugh about bad films and how we enjoy watching them because they're so crap. But I did start to feel a bit bad about that because watching this film was about someone who was so passionate and the films didn't really work out. But, God, they were trying. And Plan 9 from Outer Space, in a different context, it may be celebrated as a surreal masterpiece because it is so strange and so obviously a constructed film. It's the kind of thing that French academics 20 years later may have celebrated as a masterpiece.
Yeah, and I think you've also got to remember that Ed was operating under a lot of constraints as well. I mean, the one thing this movie, I think, shows is in a critical light is the role of producers in movies.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, for this one, this was the one that had religious people.
He had to get backing by a Baptist church. Because he convinced them that when this film made all this money, they could then go and make their films about the 12 apostles.
That's right.
So, and there's a scene where the entire cast and crew get baptized. And Bill Murray's in this film. This is and the scene with Bill Murray getting baptized is one of the funniest things I've ever seen Bill Murray do. Just the look on his face of kind of confusion and disgust is quite funny.
But it's a sign also of what Ed could get all his, you know, collaborators to do, which is what Bill Murray says to him. So, I mean, you know, I think he's must have been an inspiring person himself.
Yeah. Look, Ed Wood, it's widely available on DVD, 1994. It's possibly Tim Burton's masterpiece. It's an extraordinary film. I think it's quite a personal film because I think Burton shared a lot of the passions of Wood. Burton's a far better director.
Yeah. I mean, I kept thinking that watching it, that there was some similarity. He probably felt a kinship with Ed Wood in a lot of ways.
Yeah. So, look, if you've never seen Ed Wood, check it out. If you have, like us, saw it over 15 years ago, trust me, if you watch it again now, you will still love it. I'm going to play you some music from Ed Wood. It's the score was composed by Howard Shore, who, amongst other things, did the Lord of the Rings films, and it heavily uses the theremin, which is a Russian electronic device invented in the 20s that gives that kind of high-pitched squeal that we heard it in the Ghostbusters theme, and it's very common in science fiction and horror themes. So this is the main theme from Edward by Howard Shore. You're on Joy 94.9. Lorraine, Cinema Nova are doing something rather extraordinary. They have programmed a 2003 film, which is regarded as the Citizen Kane of bad movies. It's getting a screening tonight at 11 p.m, and then they're going to keep playing it for a few Saturdays after, and depending on how popular it is and whether its cult status hits Australia as much as it has in the US and the UK, they'll extend that season. You and I went to a sort of special media screening of this a couple of weeks ago, where we were supplied with alcohol and the audience were packed out with fans of the film who know when to call out certain things during the screening, because this is the kind of film where you're encouraged to make noise and to yell abuse at the screen and to make fun of it, because it's the only possible way you can enjoy the film.
Mm.
How did you find the experience that is The Room?
Look, it's very funny. Not intentionally so.
Yes, it's not.
It's kind of in... I think we'll have a hard time conveying actually exactly what it's like. It's sort of indescribable in some ways, but...
It's not intentionally funny,
no.
As you said, and it's been written, produced, directed, and the lead actor is all the one guy, this
Tommy Wiseau.
Tommy Wiseau, who's got this strange accent that's a little bit like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
It's
unusual looking as well.
And really unusual looking. And so it's this vanity project, and it's sort of like Days of Our Lives or General Hospital. It's a bit like an American soap opera, but just so ineptly made, such bad melodrama cheesiness,
yeah,
that it's very funny. He's actually since said it's meant to be a dark comedy.
Yeah, which I don't think is what it was originally marketed as.
I think that's absolute bollocks. Well, yeah. The rest of the cast and the crew, when asked, was it deliberately a comedy, they've apparently shook their head and said, no, this was a film that we were taking seriously. I mean, just on a technical level, the camera often goes out of focus.
Mm.
That kind of match on action you need to do when you edit a film properly is all out of sync. Continuity is a mess. There's even a character who's played by two different actors. This is not sort of, I mean, Louis Buñuel did that in one of his surrealist films, but I don't think that's quite the same thing that's going on here. And just the dialogue is so incredibly bad.
The one thing about that, though, as well, is that it's also quite misogynist at times, which, so there's a, you know,
it's really dodgy.
Yeah, I mean, I think you might have said, and I read someone else that, say that they reckon he must have got dumped just before making this film.
Yes,
it's a revenge in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know if that's confirmed, but it had to have happened. I mean, the story is he's meant to be this wonderful guy who provides for his future wife. She's never called a fiancé. She is my future wife. I love her very much. I did not hit her. I did not.
That's quite good, Thomas.
I kind of got his voice there.
Yeah.
And she's just a bitch. She's got
a grasping mother as well, who's obsessed with financial security.
Yeah, who tells her things like, you can't do anything without him.
Mm.
He is, you know, because she's a woman, of course, she can't survive by herself. She needs this guy. And so what does she do? She's a complete bitch. She sleeps with his best friend.
Mark.
Oh, hi, Mark. We should say every film starts off with the characters just saying, oh, hi, to each other. Oh, hi, Mark. Oh, hi, Lisa.
That's right.
And hi, Denny.
Yeah, they just arrive and then they say they've got to go.
Every scene opens, I got to go, I'm really busy. there's plot appears in this film that goes nowhere. There's a scene where the mother talks about her cancer results and how she's got cancer, and you never hear that again for the rest of the film.
Mm.
It seems like this big, important piece of information, as cancer tends to be, and it goes nowhere. There's a character who is dealing drugs and he gets attacked by a drug dealer. And
that's
this
a hilarious scene on the rooftop.
Teary confrontation, and it goes nowhere.
Yeah.
We never hear about that again. I had an absolute ball. Apparently when the Nova are going to screen this, they are going to put the people in the audience to yell out at the screen, because that really made it. Those guys who are in the cinema with us were hilarious.
Yeah, and you haven't mentioned the plastic spoons.
Yeah, okay, well, let's talk about some of the things that you do to interact with this film, because interaction is essential. One of the things is there's all this artwork that appears of spoons. Spoons just are in all these paintings. So you're meant to come to the cinema with plastic spoons and yell them at the screen. screen and scream out spoons. What are some of the other ones? Every time one of the women speak, you're meant to yell out things like...
That's because you're a woman.
That's because you're a woman, to make fun of the film's misogyny.
And when you're looking at the... Is it the Golden Gate Bridge that we, the Golden Gate, keep seeing? That,
yeah.
So you're meant to yell, go, 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 as you pan across the bridge.
Yes, because there's a lot of completely unnecessary pans and filler material. And so as the camera pans across the bridge, yeah, you're meant to cheer it on to make sure it gets to the other side. And if the camera doesn't make it, the whole audience goes, ah. There's... ridiculous amount of establishing shots of San Francisco. So, and the audience we saw it with really got into these. Every time we got a shot of San Francisco, everybody chanted, "Meanwhile, in San Francisco." And then one of these guys who was planted in the audience also kept on yelling out, "Where's this film set? I'm uncertain of what we're looking at right now."
Yeah.
It's
a strange kind of experience, though, as well, because you do feel a bit like you're involved in... group aggression or something with your response to the film as well. I think that's why I found it, like, while it's very
a bit
funny,
mean, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, like what you were saying earlier about Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Plan 9 from Outer Space is a far better film than The Room.
Probably much better intentioned, yeah.
Look, it's really, I can't stress this enough, people. Go and see this film. And we've watched bits of it on YouTube, and it's quite funny just by itself. But if you see it in an audience and you've had a few drinks and there are people who are helping to encourage that yelling at the screen, it is so much fun. Yeah. I had an absolute riot seeing this. And I found it liberating because I'm a bit of a cinema Nazi. I'm like, nope, no noise. I hate people rustling chip packets. I hate people with their phones. I want to bury them in their forehead.
And missing bits of dialogue.
Yeah, like, it doesn't matter. If you miss half, it really doesn't matter. You can walk in and out of this film whenever you like. Well, we haven't even mentioned the sex scenes, which are long, anatomically incorrect, like the angles these people pull.
Yeah, and the roses that are...
And the bizarre rose metaphors, yeah. Okay, so I'm going to call it. The film itself, I'm going to give 0 stars.
Yeah, well, yes.
It's that incompetent.
Yeah, me too.
But as an experience, it's a very high 4-star out of 5 experience.
Yeah, I'll go with that too.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun. Check it out. You'll be doing yourselves a big favour. You're with Thomas and Maureen here on the Casting Couch. This is Joy 94.9. You are on the Casting Couch with Thomas and Maureen. Just before those announcements, we heard Stago Lee by Pacific Gas and Electric from the soundtrack to Death Proof, a tribute to exploitation cinema. Now, Michael Adams was one of the co-hosts of SBS's The Movie Show and currently writes for Empire Magazine, among many other things. He has also worked in the film industry behind the scenes and in front of the camera, including getting to do a scene with a lingerie-clad Petra Wilson. Michael can also be seen in George A. Romero's upcoming Survival of the Dead, where he plays a zombie that gets shot in the head. Michael joins us on the line to discuss his recently published book, Showgirls, Teen Wolves and Astro Zombies, about the year he spent watching all the worst films ever made in order to discover which one was the worst of all. Michael, thank you for your time.
Thomas, thank you for having me on, mate.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you on. I'm sitting here with Maureen. We've been chatting
Hi, Michael.
We've been chatting about bad films for a lot of this show. I guess the question people really want to know is, why did you subject yourself to this?
I am kind of like Borat. When they ask Borat why he shoots bears, he says, for fun. the idea struck me. It wasn't sort of a stunt, as in, hey, I know this will be something that people will be interested in. I saw a movie called Material Girls, horrible little teen comedy with Hilary and Hayley Duff, produced by Madonna. Say no more.
Wow, ouch.
Ouch, triple ouch, yeah. I mean, the Olsen twins turned this script down, so there you go. that's a sort of indication of how bad it sucked.
Yeah.
So I had to watch this for working for Empire Magazine, and I went to check it on the Internet Movie Database. At that point, it was the number one on the bottom 100 user-voted worst films of all time. So I was like, man, that movie was terrible. It wasn't the worst I've ever seen already. I've seen, you know, Santa with Muscles, for instance, or the works of Uwe Boll.
Oh, yeah.
Blood Rain or Alone in the Dark. So it struck me, what's the worst movie ever made? I foolishly, I wouldn't let it go. And then double foolishly went, okay, well, rather than just, hey, think this is a good idea and maybe that would be a fun thing to do or an interesting thing to do, I went straight to Amazon and I dropped about $750 buying absolute crap that you guys would pay not to see.
Yeah.
So there I was committed. The New Year was coming up. It was like, okay, well, I'll try and find the worst film ever made. There were so many that I thought, well, it'll be a year's quest and I'd do it at the rate of one a day.
Wow, because when I first heard about this project, I thought, what a brilliant idea. I wish I thought of that. That's really cool. And then it occurred to me, would I hate my life about a week into this project for having to watch all these films?
Yeah, it depends. Like, I think I'm lucky in the sense that I was working for Empire, and during the year, which is recounted in the book, because it's sort of the story of the year as opposed to just a bunch of reviews.
You've written it like a memoir, haven't you?
It is, yeah. It's a memoir of that year. It gives me a chance to sort of, you know, reflect on movies in general in my life and stuff like that. You know, it's quite self-indulgent. But
I think you've earned the right to be indulgent after this.
Oh, thank you, sir. I was lucky in the sense that I did have, you know, a job which demanded me see other movies. I have a very strong family life. You know, I've got a very supportive partner. I have, at the time, my daughter was 14 months old, so I had to actually extract myself from bad movie world and, you know, pay attention to other things. Otherwise, I think, you know, if I was a man of independent means, so to speak, you know, you could really go down the rabbit hole and probably watch, you know, much more than one a day and kind of lose perspective. So it was grueling, you know, when you're sitting down watching Dracula versus Frankenstein, which is blurring into blood of ghastly horror because half the footage is recycled from one film to the next. It's 11:30 at night, you've got to be up at work, you know, up for work at 6 the next morning. You do wonder, why am I doing this? But, yeah, there was just enough sort of interesting, weird stuff that you come across to sort of, you know, keep you going.
How many films did you get through?
I clocked up 406 all told, so I set myself one a day. But what happened was at the end of, you know, the year, December, the job's finished up for the year, so I had, like, you know, woohoo, 2 weeks off. So what did I do? I watched, like, you know, 3 or 4 bad movies a day all through December. That's when it got a bit crazy, and, like, my other half was... I could tell that Claire wasn't into it anymore when she said, hey, I'm really not into this anymore, I can't wait for the year to be over, so... But it was only a year. I mean, there's, you know, a lot worse things you could do for a year.
So, hi, Michael. It's Maureen here. In the intro to the book, you said you were actually going to try and track down some of the people who were actually involved in the making of these films. So,
yeah.
How did that go? Did you end up talking to quite a few?
I did. I mean, not nearly as many as I would have liked because so many of them have met, you know, horrible ends.
Right.
I mean, I would love to have talked to Michael Finlay about, you know, Streak of the Mutilators and Snuff, but unfortunately his life ended when he was, you know, chopped to pieces by an exploding helicopter. Ed Wood, as we all know, had a sorry demise as an alcoholic. Al Adamson, who made, like, you know, dozens of exploitation movies, was, you know, had his head caved in and was buried in a spa by a contractor. So it was bizarre how many of these guys, you know, didn't see out their lives in a gentle way. But yeah, I did interview Dolores Fuller, who was played Sarah Jessica Parker in the movie Ed Wood. She was girlfriend back in the day.
Yeah.
She's like 83, and I didn't realise when, you know, I arranged with her husband to do the interview that she'd had 2 strokes and a catastrophic car accident in the last sort of 5 years. And she's like 85, so, you know, it was a pretty slow, difficult interview, but she was great. But in terms of more recent guys, like, I spoke to Philip Mora, the Australian filmmaker, who's from Melbourne, who made Howling 2 and 3. And he was just hilarious. He thought it was, you know, he was chuffed to be, you know, being talking about these schlock movies he made back in the day.
Which one is Howling the Marsupials? Is that 2 or 3?
That's number 3, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I think on my scale, it's probably just not quite as funny as Howling 2, but, you know, they're both hilarious. If you get a chance to watch them, you should. But in terms of other guys, like, I was really nervous. When it comes down to it, like, I was rating the films out of 100 to try and find the worst one. And as the year kind of progressed, you know, in the first 2 weeks, I found one, which I gave 12 out of 100, and I thought, wow, is it possibly going to be something worse? And as the year progressed, yes, there were other 12 out of 100. And then because of the volume of films I was watching towards the end, I encountered all these really big stinkers that went, you know, down to 9, 5, and then I found these 2, which were 4 out of 100. And I contacted both of the guys. And, you know, they were very good sports about it. One guy, Scott Shaw, was like, hey, man, that's awesome. You know, you see my movie, you love my movie, you hate my movie, I don't care, as long as you see it, you know? And I was like, and he just sent me an email a couple of weeks ago back saying, I bought the book, it's fantastic, good on you. The other guy was a bit more, kind of concerned about, because his movie I watched like really close to the end of the year, and I was like, I've got to call this guy up. And it's like, it's New Year's Eve almost. I don't really want to call this guy and ruin the end of his year by saying, hey man, you made the worst film I've ever seen. So I left it, and then about 5 or 6 months ago, as I was writing the epilogue, I did take the bullet, and I called him, and he was fine. I mean, he said, you know, he never expected the film to be released. He would have tried harder if he knew it was going to be released. But he's like, you know, he's founded a film festival in Buffalo, New York, and he's made, you know, he reckons he's got 22 other films in development. So he said to me, hey, I made a movie and got paid for it. Not everyone can say that. And, you know, I certainly can't.
Well, when we were reviewing Ed Wood, we were talking about how there is a sort of, we admired the spirit behind these people who got up and made these films anyway. And the fact that they just get made sometimes is a miracle and worth celebrating in its own end.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, go out and try and make one with your friends. You know, you might think you can do it. But, see if you can make one and then actually get someone like, you know, who's living on the other side of the world to actually see it, which I did in the case of these movies. Mm. It's probably a lot harder than you think. And, you know, you don't have to say that the people have made a good film, but you kind of got to give them a nod for having a go.
Yeah.
So are we wrong to be laughing at these films and having fun at them?
I'm sorry?
Is it bad for us to be having a laugh at these films?
I don't think so, not at all. I mean, like, you know, I know The Room is showing at the Nova tonight.
We were just talking about The Room, yeah.
You guys have got to see it. One of the guys, I showed it up here
it's
in
so
Sydney
good.
At the launch of my book on Monday. It was a sold-out crowd. Mm. The laughter was non-stop for 99 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Chad from The Chaser the next day tweeted, that was the funniest 90 minutes of my life. And I'd have to say, I don't think I've been in too many movie audiences where people have had a better time.
Yeah, look, that is exactly what we were saying beforehand. I'm just wondering, what in your book, have any films crept their way in there that are from otherwise distinguished directors and writers who, you know, otherwise do very good cinema?
Oh, God, yeah. Like, you know, there's a chapter on Lucas and Spielberg when they did, respectively, 1941 and Lucas produced Howard the Duck.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, you know, there's just about every A-lister you can imagine has made or been involved in a terrible film at some point in time.
Yeah, Showgirls is the classic, really, isn't it?
Showgirls is a good one. But look at the Oscars this year. I mean, some of the nominations. Avatar, all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
James Cameron got his start making Piranha 2,
yeah.
The Flying Killers. you know, Sandy Bullock got her start in Hangman, made Speed 2, made Miss Congeniality 2, which is awful. You know, Quentin Tarantino's got a pretty good track record, but he apparently did a script punch-up on the film It's Pat, and it is a diabolical, horrible film. I don't know if his script changes made it better or worse. It's hard to think you could actually make it worse. But so, yeah, and then, like, you know, Jennifer Aniston, Brad Pitt, you know, they've all, Leo DiCaprio, Nicole Kidman, they all started in really sort of, you know, schlocky films because, you know, well, you do what you need to when you're young and need the money.
Yeah, exactly. We can all fall from grace and start off badly. I'm just wondering what if you had any sort of criteria for these films. For example, a lot of people, there's been a real trend, I think, of the last 20 years of deliberately making kitsch and camp films.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, John Ward is a very good example of someone who does it truly out of love, and I think his films are therefore very good as a result. But did you come across any of these films that sort of try to be deliberately trashy and as a result they do just suck?
No. I tried to exclude anything that was deliberately camp kitsch.
Yeah.
So, you know, the works of, I love John Waters' stuff.
Mm.
And, you know, even his early films where the technique is pretty raw, they're still just hilarious and he's in control. Stuff like, you know, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes or Killer Clowns from Outer Space, I deliberately excluded those.
Mm.
So it was pretty much films that were trying to actually achieve certain aims and just missing the mark so widely.
Mm.
Michael, you say at one point early in the book that no one sets out to make a bad movie, so what do you think happens? Are there particular elements or something that will guarantee it's a bad movie?
I don't think so, no. I think, you know, like, you can look at... I mean, I just found out that Michael Bay made $130 million last year, which makes me so angry because that man made, you know, Transformers 2, which he spent $250 million on, had the most cutting-edge special effects, had DreamWorks and Paramount behind him, and that was the piece of poo that he put on cinema screens. Unfortunately, it made a lot of money, so there'll be a Transformers 3. At the other end of the scale, someone like Ed Wood, I think I hate Michael Bay more, or hate his modus operandi more, because, you know, he's just so cynical. He's absolutely indifferent to storytelling, character. He just doesn't give a you know what I'm saying. Ed Wood, on the other hand, you know, he tried as hard as he could from all accounts and was just hopeless. So you've got to kind of, you know, admire the heart of that. But I think there are so many things that can go wrong. I mean, film's a collaborative process. You know, if it's an independent, you might not have the resources or the talent to make it good. And if you're at the other end, you know, someone like Michael Bay, you're just so filled with hubris and so blind by, you know, everybody saying yes to you, that, you know, you make something like that. So there's a million things that can go wrong. I mean, the true miracle is when you get a film like The Hurt Locker or Inglourious Basterds or An Education, which just goes so right, because so many things can go wrong.
Michael, can you tell us what was the very worst film that you saw, or do we have to get the book?
Okay, anybody who's listening who wants to hear the worst film has to make a mental promise to go out and buy it.
Yeah, that's a fair play, yep.
Dark Harvest 2, The Maze. This is by the guy up in upstate New York. I rated this 4 out of 100.
What's that title again?
It's Dark Harvest 2, yeah. The Maze. Okay, and The Maze, the title in itself is a giveaway to some extent.
Yeah.
The Maize is spelled M-A-I-Z-E, as in corn, okay? So it's a cornrow maize, get it, right?
Yep.
He actually called it The Maize, colon, the movie. One of his friends shopped it to Lionsgate, who had to be the most cynical distributor in the history of cinema.
Yep.
They had a small DVD hit with a film called Dark Harvest about a killer scarecrow. So what they did was they slapped the new title, Dark Harvest 2, The Maze, on it, put a cover on the DVD, which is really slick-looking, with this, you know, scarecrow with a big blade looking really evil. And when I actually put it on, I thought, well, this isn't going to be too bad, because I thought at that point I'd actually seen the worst film I could possibly find. And it's just awful. There's 8 minutes with this guy. The story is pretty much reduced to this writer, director, producer, star, Bill Cowell, trying to find his two daughters in a maze, in this corn maze. And it's a, you know, drooping tendrils. The maze is dead. It's a grey sky. It's been raining. It's muddy. It's like, it looks like a black and white film because everything's now so leached of colour. He spends about 40 minutes, no word of a lie, so I'm just calling out, girls, girls, where are you? There is an 8-minute sequence where he is on his hands and knees digging in a mud puddle, and that is it. 8 minutes, unbroken. It's like, you know, you could seriously stare at a blank screen for 2 hours and you could think more. It's truly awful. But the other one that I rated 4 out of 100 as well didn't win by virtue of the fact that it only went for 78 minutes. And Dark Harvest 2 Maze goes for 108 minutes. So, you know,
yeah,
it's way half an hour more of my life.
Pushing it. Michael, you've taken several bullets for all of us, and the result is a rather extraordinarily looking at fun book called Showgirls, Teen Worlds and Astro Zombies, which I gather is now out and available everywhere.
It is indeed.
We've been talking to Michael Adams. Michael, thank you so much for joining us on the Casting Couch. It's been really fun chatting with you.
Thank you, guys. Happy schlocking around the clock. You should have yourselves a bad movie festival. It's a lot of fun.
Yep. You might just have an idea there I'm willing to steal. Thank you, Michael.
Bye, Michael.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
You're in Joy 94.9.
My name is Renee Geyer, and I support Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9. Be there.
You're back on the Casting Couch with Thomas and Maureen. And, hey, we've been talking so much about bad films, we haven't yet done a giveaway for a film that's a good one. We've got... That was terrible grammar. That made no sense. Oh, well, let's just start that again. We've got 5 double passes, in-season double passes, for Precious to give away. This is the Academy Award-nominated film that Maureen and I reviewed very favourably earlier in the show. So we've got 5 of those to give away. You need to be a Joy member, and you can't have won a prize from Joy in the past 2 weeks. So to get in touch, send us an SMS on 0427-JOY-949. Give Warren a call on 1300-JOY-949 or shoot us an email at onair@joy.org.au. We'll keep the competition open for about 5 minutes, so until about 6.55. Just get in touch with us as soon as possible. We'll draw 5 winners from a hat and you'll get those double passes to Precious. Now I'm going to go back to some music. I'm going to play you the title song from the film Absolute Beginners. This was a film by Julian Temple that was done in 1986 that most people hated, and I think most people regard as a bad film, but I love it. So keeping the theme of the show, this is David Bowie singing the theme to Absolute Beginners. You're on the Casting Couch, Joy 94.9. And you're back on the Casting Couch with Thomas and Maureen. That was David Bowie with Absolute Beginners. Now, we did do a call out at the start of the show for people to get in touch with us with their favourite bad movie, and we've been reading them out. We didn't get to ask Michael about any of the films because, look, he just had so many he had to tell us about that we just didn't get the time. But we have got a few more messages from people with their bad movie picks that we haven't read out yet, so let's just get through this now. We've got a message here saying, love the program. Thank you. Worst movie I ever saw was War of the Worlds with Tom Cruise. Only film I've ever walked out on. Did not want to go in the first place and never dated that guy again. That's from Bruin in Bendigo. Thanks for that. Have you seen the Tom Cruise War of the Worlds, Maureen?
No, I
actually quite enjoyed it for about two-thirds of the way through, and then it went downhill quite badly. This is quite a long one. Let's go through this. The worst film I can remember, the memory thankfully protects our conscious lives and painful experience, was The Prisoner of St. Petersburg, seen at one of my favourite cinemas a couple of decades ago. I usually have a high tolerance for pretentiousness, but even my brain started to explode at this self-indulgence. It's not the only time I've walked out of a film, admittedly partly because I didn't know when the last tram home left, not counting the time my father took me out of a film on Gothic period art when I was 8 because I was whining. So that's The Prisoner of St. Petersburg, and that's coming from Marcus as his worst film.
Haven't seen that one either.
I haven't and I shan't. That sounds horrible, horrible, horrible. All right, let's go to some more music. We were talking about John Waters before. John Waters is going to be touring Australia with his spoken word show. I have tickets. I'm most excited.
Yeah, that'll be good.
Now, one of the bad movie genres from the 50s is the teen juvenile genre, films about, you know, teenagers acting up. And John Waters did a wonderful tribute to teen juvenile delinquent films with Crybaby. So I'm going to play from that High School Hellcats. You're on the Casting Couch, Joy 94.9. We do love being bad, and it does feel good. That's sort of the theme of the show on the Casting Couch here today. We're about to wrap up. Yep. Maureen, we've got some winners for the double passes to see Precious.
We have. There's Henry from Fitzroy, Peter from Carlton, Agnes from Coburg, Robert from South Yarra, and Marlo from Lara.
Congratulations to all of you. Warren will be in touch about organising how you can collect those prizes. Speaking of Warren, thank you very much for taking care of everything at the front desk for us today. We certainly enjoy it when Warren is on board. As we feel the same way about Alan, our producer and panellist, a big thank you. Thank you to Sonia for looking after the news reading duties for us, and a massive thank you to Michael Adams, who has taken this incredible bullet by writing the book Showgirls, Teen Wolves and Astro Zombies, where he watched just horrific films for an entire year. We had a lot of fun speaking with him. Maureen, it's always wonderful to share the microphone with you.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks, Thomas.
Yeah, next week, Kylie Eddy will be on deck to have a go at presenting the show with me, and Maureen, no doubt, will be seeing you very soon over the coming weeks as well. Coming up next, Dennis and Dick here on Joy 94.9. You have been listening to The Casting Couch. Good night.
See ya.
Bond. James Bond.
The Casting Couch, Joy 94.9's premiere movie show.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.